This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow night, President Bush delivers an important speech to introduce his new policy on Iraq. After last fall's elections and the continued unpopularity of the war, this may be the president's last chance on Iraq. He's widely expected to call for an additional 20,000 combat troops to work with additional Iraqi forces, try to impose some semblance of security in a situation that looks more and more like civil war. And he's changed his high command, including a new Secretary of Defense, a new theater commander, and a new commander in Iraq to help carry out this new approach. Today, questions and answers about Iraq. If you have questions about politics in Washington or Baghdad, about tactics and strategy, about the timing and length of deployments, about Iraq's economy, the role of diplomacy and regional powers, about whatever, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, the results of the voting for baseball's Hall of Fame. But first, question and answers on Iraq. We're joined now by David Sanger, the chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Nice to speak with you again, David.
Good to be here.
And also with us, Thomas Ricks, who reports on the U.S. military for The Washington Post and the author of the book Fiasco, about the war in Iraq. He's with us from a studio at The Washington Post. Tom Ricks, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
David Sanger, here's an email for you. Describe troop surge, what makes it different from the policies we've already seen, and why does the president think this strategy will work? That's from Ryan in Detroit, Michigan.
Well, Ryan asks a good question because I think one of the big issues that the White House is going to have to answer tomorrow after the president's speech is why this is different from past troop surges. We have seen troop surges at various moments in the past. They haven't been announced as such, but we saw in the summer when there were two efforts to subdue the violence in Baghdad, an increase in troops. I think what the difference is here is twofold. First, we're going to see a larger increase, although many would argue not large enough, upwards of 20,000 troops, but not all at once. They're going to be phased in about one brigade a month.
A brigade about 5,000 people?
Brigade about 4,000, and you'll probably start with two and move your way up. And then we are told that there will be a difference in how they are deployed within Baghdad. In the past, we've gone into neighborhoods, cleared them, and left the Iraqis to hold them. And they didn't hold, which meant, of course, that we had to, as we moved on, we had to circle back then and go and do it a second time. This time, we're told, American troops will be left behind in some of these neighborhoods to make sure that there is a sense of security that the people have within these neighborhoods at that time and keep both the militias and the Sunni insurgents from moving back in. And that there'll be a very even-handed approach, that we'll be doing some Shia neighborhoods and some Sunni neighborhoods. But it's unclear to us whether or not there'll be enough forces to make a difference in a city of 6.5 million people.
Mm-hmm. This is a question from Chet in Palatine, Illinois. If President Bush is planning on ordering a surge of troops, where exactly are these troops coming from? Isn't our military currently stretched thin with many soldiers on their second and third tours? Tom Ricks?
The military is stretched thin, and in fact, since the election and since the departure of Secretary Rumsfeld, top commanders have been much more willing to talk openly about how the military is stretched thin, and the Army especially needs to be bigger. They don't really have a lot of troops on the shelf. As one Pentagon official likes to say to me, we're out of Schlitz. So what you do is you kind of fiddle at the margins. You extend the tours of duty of troops who are out there now. You accelerate the deployment of troops planning to go out there, and you perhaps activate some reserve units that hadn't been planned to be activated quite so soon.
And this is going to involve how many people overall, do you think?
I think around 20,000. Actually, we've actually spiked up to that number briefly before. At the end of 2005, we briefly had about 165,000 troops in Iraq for a period of elections. It didn't last the whole month. But it was probably more than I think you'll ultimately see deployed under this plan.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email. This from Juan in Charlotte, North Carolina. I heard there was a bill floating around Congress that proposes the creation of a permanent army base in Iraq. Is this true? If so, would your guests care to comment? David Sanger, what do you know about this?
I don't know if there's a bill, but there's been constant discussion of this question of whether or not we would have permanent bases in Iraq. I think that many in the administration recognize that that would certainly worsen the Iraqi allergy to the sense that they are being occupied. I would doubt that that's going to happen. And I would doubt it in part because you saw what happened with our bases in Saudi Arabia, which were put in place after, remained in place after the Gulf War in the early 90s and were basically dismantled as we went into Iraq, in part not to arouse the ire of the Saudis.
Mm-hmm. And does the military, Tom Ricks, do they talk of permanent bases in Iraq?
No, I don't think they particularly like the idea. I don't know a lot of people in the U.S. military who like being in Iraq, even though almost everybody in active duty, I think, at this point has been through at some point in the last few years. They're very conscious also that one of al-Qaeda's main recruiting points has been the presence of U.S. forces in the region, most notably in Saudi Arabia when we had a large number of troops there because it's the Muslim Holy Land. And so I think they're very wary, very careful. And in fact, the whole U.S. military is moving away from the big overseas base structure and more to what they call a lily pad structure, where you have the ability to go to a country quickly, not stay for long, do what you want to do, and then get out, which is probably a more appropriate approach for a relatively small professional military like the one we have.
Let's get to a caller, and this is Bill. Bill's with us on the line from Jackson in Wyoming.
Hi, I just wondered if anyone there could speculate on what possible benefit the administration thinks the United States might get by not speaking to Iran and Syria and the other countries involved in the Iraq situation.
That was one of the principal recommendations of the Iraq Study Group, which, of course, issued its suggestions last month. David Sanger, our chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times.
I think that it's going to be really interesting to listen to what the president has to say about Iran during his speech. He has said in the past that we talk to Syria through our embassy there, but the fact of the matter is that we don't talk to them very much or very deeply, and the Iraq Study Group's co-chairman, the former Secretary of State James Baker, made the point that he had been to Syria more than a dozen times during his time as Secretary of State, and that the regime then was not a whole lot more pleasing to Washington than it is now. What the president has said about Iran is that we would talk to them as soon as they agreed to give up the enrichment of uranium, or at least suspend it, and that we would then join talks with the Europeans. The Iranians have refused to do that, and they've refused a UN demand to do that. And I think that the administration's view is that to talk to them now, having set that marker out, would be an early sign of weakness. Now, the argument on the other side is the Iranians are in Iraq. They are gaining influence there. They would love nothing more than to see the country broken up into constituent parts in which they would get the Shia majority or get an alliance with the Shia majority in the south and much of that oil. And so the Baker-Hamilton Commission's conclusion was, you may like them, you may not like them, you've got to talk to them.
Bill, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you.
Here's an email. We'll send this one to Tom Ricks at the Washington Post from Hartmut in Margate, Florida. Why isn't anyone talking about reinstituting the draft? Isn't that the only thing that would get all Americans interested in the course of this war?
Well, the first major reason you don't hear anybody talking about reinstituting the draft is that U.S. military commanders loathe the idea. The senior officers today were the junior officers of the 1970s, and they can remember when they were getting mugged in the barracks and had to carry pistols simply for self-protection on bases from their own soldiers. So they don't want a bunch of surly, unwilling draftees around. And for all the problems the U.S. military has had in Iraq, I am constantly struck by the professionalism and the unit cohesion, the camaraderie of soldiers on the ground in Iraq. You don't see it in all units. Some National Guard units that have been cobbled together have some hard times. But the active duty military is an extraordinarily professional, well-trained institution, really the opposite of the Army that you sometimes saw on the ground in Vietnam. That's the first reason. The second reason is that after Social Security, the draft is probably one of the most powerful third rails in American politics. Except for Representative Charlie Rangel, I know of very few members of Congress who actually like the idea of a draft. That said, yeah, it would make American society pay more attention to all those 21-year-old, 19-year-old kids getting killed out in Iraq. It would bring the war home to people a bit more. This is one reason I hear some people talk about a special war tax to pay the tab for the war, which is running about $1.7 billion a week right now.
Mm. Neil, can I add a quick point on this? The president has said to some visitors to the Oval Office that he didn't think this war could be sustainable if, in fact, there was a draft on. And I think you have to ask the question, great is the political opposition to a surge or what Democrats would call an expansion of the war is now. Can you imagine what that would be like if there was a draft? During the Vietnam era, there were protests in the streets. There have not been very many protests in the streets here. And that's because, in part, there is a sense that whether the war is a good mission or a bad mission, people knew what they were signing up for.
Is it fair to also say the president has limited political capital after the elections and after the Republican losses and given his unpopularity in the opinion polls, and that he does not wouldn't want to spend it whatever there is on instituting a draft?
I think that's right, and it would make it much harder to execute the policy that he's got. I saw in USA Today their poll this morning showed his approval ratings at 26%. I think that who knows if that's too low. You know, all of these, including our own polls, have a margin of error to them. But a president who's down in that region is not going to suggest starting a draft.
Questions and answers today on Iraq. Our guests, David Sanger and Thomas Ricks, and we're taking your calls and emails. The number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. After the break, we'll be joined by NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins as well. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, where tomorrow night President Bush unveils his new plan for Iraq in a speech from the White House. Today, we're taking your questions on Iraq about tactics and strategy, timing, troop deployments, about politics and diplomacy. Our guests are David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, and Thomas Ricks, military reporter for the Washington Post, author of Fiasco, the American Military Adventure in Iraq. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us now is Lauren Jenkins, NPR's senior foreign editor, and he's with us also here in Studio 3A. Why don't we begin with one for you, Lauren? This is from Gabe in Napa, California, who emails, "It seems like the new plan will depend very heavily on Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki's government. Maliki, however, has stated he would not be seeking a second term and that he wishes this term were over as soon as possible. He obviously no longer wants the job he has, so I question the commitment and capability of the current Iraqi government and the wisdom of depending on them so heavily. So when does Maliki's term actually expire? How will the next administration be chosen, and by whom, and who might be a likely successor?"
Boy, that's a lot of questions, especially in Iraq, where everything is quite changeable. Maliki's term is up when the parliament's term is up, unless he gets voted out of office or the coalition changes any time in the next, I believe it's a four-year term.
The coalition of parties
in the parliament, mm-hmm. And he serves at their, he's their choice of the actual parliamentarians chose him, and he could resign any time, or they could change the coalition. The problem with this plan is, in fact, his government, which has, and especially him, because he and his party depend heavily on Muqtada Sadr, who's the hothead Islamist who has the biggest militia. And part of any plan's function is going to be the U.S. ability, and the U.S. and Iraqi ability, to disarm and curb the militias that are now at the forefront of the sectarian violence. So far, Maliki has done nothing about the militias because they're his allies.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Will. Will, with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes. Thank you. My question is, I've just read a newspaper article that the UN forces in Afghanistan are going to be requesting more and additional U.S. troops come spring, when they expect a Al-Qaeda, Taliban raise in violence. How is the president going to handle both the surge now and that when it comes in a few months?
The fighting generally dies down in Afghanistan over the winter and then picks up, and last spring it picked up a lot. Thomas Ricks.
That's a question dear to my heart. I used to live in Afghanistan when I was a teenager, and was very conscious even then, back in the late 60s and early 70s, that guerrilla warfare is the Afghan national sport. And indeed, spring is when they come out of spring training. The passes open up, and in the low areas, they get their planting done, and then you can go out and have a good fight. I think it's a real problem, and it's something the Joint Chiefs have been aware of, as they've been rather skeptical about the White House talking about a surge. The two reasons for skepticism have been, first, in Iraq, what do you plan to do with these troops? The second reason, equally important in their eyes, is this basically does take care of the American reserves. You don't have any reinforcements left on the shelf for precisely this sort of situation in Afghanistan. So I think they're very worried about that. And I think you're going to see the United States, as an answer, lean very heavily on NATO allies to contribute more forces into Afghanistan. The problem there is that each NATO ally comes with its own series of regulations imposed by its government about what exactly its troops can do and can't do. They cannot be used freely by U.S. generals as they would with American troops.
And just let me follow up on that with David Sanger. There have been questions raised about nakedness of American forces. What if something happens with Iran, with North Korea, with China, any number of crises blowing up? Who knows, Somalia is just blowing up.
You know, Neil, this discussion takes me back to an interview I did with President Bush when he was president-elect. It was just about 10 days before his first inaugural. And he said that one of the first issues that he wanted to address was the fact that we had some divisions of the U.S. military that were not ready for battle. And this was, he thought, because of the strain that Bosnia had put on the military. Well, you know, where are we now, 6.5 years later, 6 years later? We're a lot further down that line. And, you know, I think one of the big questions that historians are going to grapple with in this remarkable period of time that we've been through is whether or not North Korea would have proceeded with its nuclear test had we not been so tied up in Iraq. Whether or not Iran would have felt so free to move ahead with its nuclear development program, they don't yet have a weapon, we believe, had we not been tied up. In fact, the White House thought the lesson of the invasion of Iraq would be the opposite, that they would be so struck by our forces that it would become a reinforcing reason for them not to go that path.
Neil, may I ask a question of my two confrères here?
Go ahead, Tom.
This is Tom in Washington, and I'd like to ask both of you something I've really been puzzling through. Does either one of you think that United States and Iraqi troops in Baghdad under this surge plan will confront Muqtada al-Sadr's militia?
Lauren, I'm going to make you answer that first.
No, I don't. I think the last time we had a Baghdad security plan last summer, we were committing, I think, 14,000 U.S. troops to it, and the Iraqi government was supposed to contribute an equal amount, I think 5 brigades. They contributed 2, and 3 were lacking. It's very hard for me to see that Maliki, given his political dependence on Muqtada al-Sadr, will allow his troops to really go after Muqtada al-Sadr's militia.
David Sanger?
As I understand this, Tom, and some of it's from reading you, it's that the plan as initially put together is not to go into Sadr City, which is, of course, the stronghold, until we see the Iraqis demonstrate that their troops are showing up, that they are willing to confront Sadr, And of course, it's sort of the worst place for Americans to be caught in the midst of that. So that's going to be the ultimate example of where we want the Iraqis to take the lead. So I guess the first order question is, do the Iraqis show up? And then the second one is, what do they do when they get there?
And which Iraqis, Lauren Jenkins, show up?
Well, can I just add one thing? We have a story tonight that will air on All Things Considered from our correspondent in Baghdad saying, basically, looking at the situation in Sadr City today, which is where 2 million of Baghdad's Shiite residents live, saying that the militia was going from house to house distributing hand grenades to all families and preparing and to batten down the hatches for a time when they might be confronted by U.S. or Iraqi troops. So that looks like a real confrontation building there, if that's what's going to happen.
All right, here's an email from Dana in Maryland. I spent 16 months in Iraq over two tours, the invasion and occupation, then all of 2004. Every time we rebuilt the oil pipeline, it was blown up again in 2 weeks. Many civil affairs soldiers were frustrated after completing a project like a police station, only to have it firebombed. How will security of so many more reconstruction sites be possible? Tom Ricks?
It's very difficult. The oil pipeline, I kept on being told, was being blown up not by the insurgents, but by the people who profit from trucking oil. And they simply didn't want the competition. It's one of those areas where insurgency and mafiosi type activity kind of blur into each other. The soldier is asking an extremely pertinent question. In an urban area of more than 5 million people, mainly living in one- and two-story houses, sprawling across that plain, exactly how will a couple of brigades of U.S. troops affect a difference? And honestly, having spent time on the ground in Iraq on six different trips there, I don't see it.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and let's go to Chuck. Chuck calling us from San Francisco.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
I am kind of curious. The Iraq Study Group seemed to be suggesting withdrawal and regional diplomacy, and it seems to me that if we got out of there, Iran would probably line up behind the Shiites, and you know, the Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, whatever would probably be sympathetic to the Sunnis. And I don't know. It just seems odd to me that they would rather fight a proxy war than work it out. So what would be the implications for the region? And wouldn't there be a strong incentive given the interests of all the countries in the region to work out the civil war problem?
Mm-hmm. David Sanger.
Chuck's gotten at one of the core debates that is taking place in Washington today. The Iraq Study Group said that the nightmare scenario here would be that Iraq devolves into civil war and then regional powers move in, or that this spreads into a war throughout the region. And then the question is, how do you avoid that? The president's answer to that is, you solve the problem in Iraq. The study group, some of its members, in their description of how they believed we had to put the responsibility on the Iraqis to take this over and that we would get into a gradual withdrawal, were making the point that they believed that the specter that we would leave would force all of the regional neighbors, just as you've described there, to begin to come to some kind of accord and for the Iraqi government itself to do that. And the answer to both of these is, we just don't know. We are in new territory here. Nobody really understands this dynamic, and it's part of what happens when you lift the lid off of a dictatorial regime.
Here's an email from Nancy in Detroit, sort of on the same scale. Mr. Ricks was on C-SPAN a while back, and if I recall correctly, he said something to the effect that if nothing else, the Iraq Study Group report would at least force the administration or anyone else to be accountable and give solid reasons for what direction they push in Iraq. In the end, was the Iraq Study Group simply a huge waste of time and taxpayers' money?
I think the obituary for the Iraq Study Group has been written much too prematurely. I think there was a huge expectation for it, and it hasn't been met. That said, what I've been struck by over the last couple of days is that the more that members of Congress, especially Republican members of Congress, look at the Bush administration's surge plan, the more they like the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group. So I think you may see that thing come back with some ferocity as an alternative. Where Congress goes on this is going to be really interesting. I think the congressional Republicans are extremely nervous about the Bush administration on Iraq. The one thing they don't want to do is go through another election in 08 like the one they just had in 06. And so they really want to see something different here, and they're worried that they're not going to get it. So I think the Iraq Study Group might kind of come back and be reconsidered. I think it already really has changed the debate. You no longer hear anybody telling you that steady progress is being made in Iraq. The questions I think that are being addressed, and I think properly so, are, okay, this is a bad situation. What is the least bad answer available? And that really has been what this debate has been about lately.
Did it change the tone at the White House, David Sanger?
The White House was certainly quite concerned about the findings of the Iraq Study Group, and the president made a pitch to the study group to get them to adopt his position. That largely failed. But I think Tom is right. And as we violate the Yogi Berra rule, which is, you know, never make predictions, especially about the future, we can make one that would go out just 48 hours, which is whatever the president says tomorrow night, by Thursday morning will be compared point by point with where the study group came out. And it will become the frame of reference so that when the president stands up and makes the argument that his strategy is the only way to go, there will be others, Republicans and Democrats, will say, well, we have an alternative model here. And then the debate has at least got some parameters.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Also with us, Thomas Ricks, who covers the U.S. military for The Washington Post. Lauren Jenkins, senior foreign editor for National Public Radio. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. An email from Terry in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Are common Americans getting an accurate picture of the causes of the violence in Baghdad? Do correspondents have access to the various factions and their leaders? You're the editor, Lauren?
Yes and no. I think you're getting as accurate a picture as you can get from the field. Movement around Iraq, independent movement around Iraq, is extremely dangerous. The streets of Baghdad, any correspondent is subject to being killed by car bombs or snipers or kidnapped. So movement is done very cautiously. So it's prescribed. Having said that, most correspondents are not in the green zone where the U.S. is in a bubble, and not necessarily understanding what goes on beyond that. They do get around. They do have access to most of the leadership are people in the various parties. I think, you know, the reporting, given all the problems, dangers to reporters, has been very good and very solid.
Mm-hmm. Let's get Bob on the line. Bob's calling us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm one of what Frank once called the minority out here. I'm a conservative calling from the heartland, the Midwest, home of Jerry Ford. And I guess I'm assuming your guess would probably lean towards closer to Senator Kennedy and his views on the war today, but I find myself as a conservative really against the war and really coming to that conclusion after kind of the mire that we're in. However, I was a supporter and continue to support our troops, et cetera, and I know that sounds like I think that's a real shift in the right wing of America, but the fact is that we are there. And I guess what I'm not seeing in the debate, because there is the political side and the calls for the political solution are valid, but what I don't see in the debate, even from our media and even maybe from some of your guests, I'd love to hear their opinions, is doesn't seem to be a challenge. Like Senator Kennedy comes out today and says we must get out of Iraq, and I know he has the extreme view, but I don't hear anybody challenging him what his solution is.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that there could be some very negative impacts of just that vacuum that we leave there by leaving.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hear anybody saying, well, Senator Kennedy, what would you do?
Yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, Bob, but I want to get an answer before we have to go to a break. David Sanger.
Well, the Iraq Study Group came up with a proposal, one that some people consider to be a bit naive, but it's one that we would perhaps do a surge, but then set a schedule for drawdown and have everybody sort of back to their bases by early 2008. And the theory of this was to put pressure on the Iraqis so that they don't believe that we are always going to be there to defend the country. The difficulty that gets into is that it runs directly into the president's insistence, understandable insistence, that he wants a victory. And then you get to the question, can we want a victory more than the Iraqis? Can we define victory differently than the Iraqis do? And even that basic definition, 3.5, nearly 4 years into this war, is still unclear. It's not clear to me that Prime Minister Maliki and President Bush, for all of their discussions, define victory and stability the same way.
Bob, thanks very much. We're going to take a short break, and we'll take a few more of your questions after we get back. Our guests are David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent of the New York Times, Thomas Ricks, who covers the military for the Washington Post, Lauren Jenkins, who's the Senior Foreign Editor for National Public Radio. We'll also be talking about the results of the balloting today for baseball's Hall of Fame. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking your questions and answers on Iraq. Our guests are David Sanger, the Chief Washington Correspondent of the New York Times, Thomas Ricks of the Washington Post, he covers the United States military for them, and Lauren Jenkins, NPR's Senior Foreign Editor. Let's get a caller in. This is Kathleen. Kathleen with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. But
sure.
we all know now that the Bush administration was wrong almost about everything in the run-up to the war, about WMDs, about the cost of the war, about how long we'd be there. And now we've got the generals and the majority of the American public and the majority of Iraqis and the majority of American soldiers all saying no, no, no on the escalation. So what I'm wondering is Representative Kucinich has been calling for the possibility of looking into international UN forces. I'm wondering how realistic that is and how many mercenaries are on the ground. And I'd also like to invite Neil Conan, Chris Matthews, and Diane Rehm to come out on the streets on January 27th and cover the marches. A lot of people are saying, oh, there haven't been many protests. Well, there have been millions of Americans who protested prior to the invasion, mm-hmm. and the media did not cover it in a well-balanced and accurate way. So, Neil, I'm inviting you, Chris Matthews, and Diane Rehm to get out on the streets with us.
We'll have to break up the poker game to do that. thanks for the call, Kathleen.
Right.
Realistic chances of UN troops in going to Iraq, David Sanger?
I've never heard that as a serious possibility for several reasons. One, UN troops tend to go in on peacekeeping operations. There is not right now a peace to keep. This is something that requires significant firepower, and if you believe that there is a military component beyond the political solution. Secondly, the UN forces right now are stretched to their own limits. They're in many different places. So I think the chances that you would get that organized would be very small, and the result would be effectively that there would not be a foreign military force there. Now, maybe there are some who argue that there shouldn't be a foreign military force, and some Iraqis who believe that. But to believe that the job that we are doing could be replaced by the UN, I think at this point is probably a bit of a stretch. I'd be interested in hearing Tom on that.
And I'd also like to ask Tom to follow up on another part of Kathleen's question. The change of commanders in not only the Central Command and on the ground in Iraq has been portrayed by a lot of the military, oh, this is just a standard rotation, yet she's right. The previous commanders opposed a surge. The new commanders seem to be in favor of one.
Well, they're both kind of right. The rotation of officers was pretty routine. I remember I was out in Baghdad last February 06, and General Casey told me he expected to step down by about this time, January 07. So it's not like he's being thrown out the window. In fact, he's being promoted to be Army Chief of Staff and now will be the only Iraq veteran sitting on the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the two last years of the Bush presidency and the first 2 years of the next presidency, which puts him in a very powerful position. So it's hardly a demotion. The offices they're putting in, though, are interesting because especially General Petraeus has had a very different take on the war. In 2003-04, General Petraeus, who's going in to replace Casey, really did the road not taken in northern Iraq with his headquarters in Mosul, very different from what most of the rest of the U.S. military did in Iraq that year, and much more productive. The question I think Petraeus is going to have to address is whether it's too late to apply those different tactics in Iraq. As for the U.N., military term, NGH, not going to happen. Among other things, the UN the UN's headquarters in Baghdad got blown up in August 2003, an event that inside the UN is regarded as their own 9/11.
Finally, an email from Kurt in Renton, Washington. From the start, I've thought that one obvious requirement for success in Iraq was to give minority Sunnis a sense of power, and that the obvious way to do that would be a bicameral parliament, with one house representing the sects proportionately and the other representing them equally much as our Congress does with our states. Was this ever considered, and if so, why was it never adopted? Lauren.
I don't think it was ever considered. It wasn't viewed as an approach. They weren't going to have an American-type democracy, first of all, if they were ever going to have a democracy, and it was always based more on a parliamentary system, which didn't include a bicameral system. That having said, yes, there can be no real political solution unless there's some reconciliation between the Shia and the Sunni, Shia majority and the Sunni minority, and that isn't happening. Mm-hmm. And that's very much on the table. If Bush's plan is going to work, it's going to have to work with a reconciliation. And if there's no reconciliation, there's not going to be any solution.
And let me just ask you two, finally, Thomas Ricks and David Sanger, if the president does call for an escalation of U.S. forces in Iraq, is there any way the Sunnis, given what we've heard is the likely reluctance to take on the Mahdi army and other Shia militias, is this going to be seen by Sunnis as an assault on them?
There's always that risk, and that's been one of the warnings that the Saudis and some other Sunni predominant nations have given to Washington. The risks for the president are several-fold here. I mean, one of them is to appear to be coming down too far on the side of the Shia and not looking even-handed. The other problem is not appearing to the Iraqi people to be solving two very different problems, the Sunni insurgency and the Shia militia issue. And then within the Shia militia issue, you get back to the question that you raise, and which I think no one has a real answer to, which is anybody willing to take on Muqtada al-Sadr? That's what makes this the long pass out here. You know, you're going to hear a plan tomorrow, and it's going to be a best guess of a different way to do things. But nobody that I know, even in the White House, certainly nobody I know in the Pentagon, is saying to me that they could predict the outcome even 3 months out.
Hmm. Thomas Ricks?
My bet is that the Sunni fighters will lay low and say, let's take a pause, 3 or 4 months here, rest, refit, train, recruit. And let's tell Sunni politicians to tell the Americans and the government, you'll get our cooperation when we see you confront the Mahdi army. And if it doesn't happen, then they can come back in 3 or 4 months and say, this is all a big lie, like we told you.
Hmm. Thomas Ricks, thanks very much, as always, for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thomas Ricks of the Washington Post, David Sanger of the New York Times with us here in Studio 3A, and Lauren Jenkins, NPR Senior Foreign Editor, also with us here in Studio 3A. Thank you both for your time as well. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Alan Schwartz about the elections today to Baseball's Hall of Fame.